Good afternoon and welcome, folks, to Connecting Communities, a series sponsored by the Federal Reserve System. I'm Daniel Davis with the St. Louis Fed. Today's focus is built around the topic of responding to gentrification in urban communities. We know that American cities are in a period of resurgence, gaining renewed interest from people who want to live and work in urban centers across the country. And the result of this resurgence is that neighborhoods near the city centers are experiencing the pressures of gentrification, especially in low and moderate income neighborhoods. During today's session, we'll uncover emerging research that explores how gentrification is being defined, the roots of its underlying causes, and the impact it's having on vulnerable residents in these cities. And we'll also hear from two local leaders who are working to proactively address gentrification's effects in the communities they serve. But before we dig into today's content, let's just take a moment to review a few items. If you'll join me on slide two of the presentation, I want to just go through some housekeeping items. First of all, we know that questions for our presenters will arise throughout today's session, and we've reserved time at the end of the session to address as many of those as we're able. Now, you have two options for asking questions. If you're using the webinar tool, you can simply click on the Ask a Question button right there in the webinar tool and submit your question to us via that platform. Or if you're not using the webinar platform or it's just easier, you're welcome to email your question to us at communities@stls.frb.org. Again, that email address is communities@stls.frb.org. Don't hesitate to shoot those questions along at any point as we're going through today's session. Also, as a reminder, we are recording today's conversation, and as soon as we conclude the session, the audio broadcast will be placed up on the Connecting Communities website, and you'll have access to it there. And lastly, on slide two, you'll see a great link for our Federal Reserve portal called fedcommunities.org. If you check out fedcommunities.org, you'll see that there are literally hundreds of community development resources from the 12 Federal Reserve banks around the country and also the Board of Governors in Washington, D.C. As you'll see at the bottom there on slide two, we encourage you to browse through the fedcommunities.org website and reach out to your local Federal Reserve representatives for any additional information on any items that you find there. Okay, join me over on slide three, and I'd like to read through a brief legal notice and disclaimer, and I'm just going to read this verbatim. It says, the information, analyses, and conclusions set forth are those of the presenters and do not necessarily indicate concurrence by the Board of Governors of the Federal Reserve System, the Federal Reserve Banks, or members of their staffs. On to slide four, you'll see that there are three ways that the Federal Reserve System is engaged in community development around the United States. If you're not already familiar with the Federal Reserve, check it out there. You'll see that the Fed is engaged in convening stakeholders, conducting and sharing research, and also in identifying emerging issues. Okay, on to the heart of today's conversation. Join me on slide five. I'd love to introduce you to today's speakers. As I mentioned earlier, this session is focused on better understanding gentrification in America's cities and also will help us understand how communities are responding to these challenges. And to accomplish this, we've gathered three distinguished presenters for today's call. First, we have Ingrid Gold-Ellen, the Paulette Goddard Professor of Urban Policy and Planning and Faculty Director at the Wagner School and Furman Center for Real Estate and Urban Policy at New York University. Also joining us, we have John Chin, of the Philadelphia Chinatown Development Corporation, who will discuss preservation and revival in Philadelphia's Chinatown neighborhood. And lastly, we have Harry Smith of Dudley Neighbors Incorporated, a Boston-based community land trust that has been active for over 25 years. Ingrid, John, and Harry, I'm so delighted that you're with us today. Before I turn the session over to Ingrid to launch her presentation, I actually want to turn to our audience members. We have a polling question to get us started today. So we're going to go ahead and launch that polling question, and it's simply this. What is your role? So as an audience member, are you an educator, a workforce board member, government policymaker, researcher, social service provider, or do you fit in that category of other? Go ahead and take a second to respond to that poll. And we're going to go ahead and close the poll, and as we're doing so, I just want to remind folks, shoot along questions anytime. You can either click on the Ask a Question tool right there in the webinar, or you can email to communities@stls.frb.org. All right. Let's see. What is your role? 60% of our audience today falls into the other category, 15% researchers, 10% government policymakers, 8% social service providers, 5% educators, and 1% workforce board members. And with that, Ingrid, we'll go on to your presentation.
Terrific. Thanks, Daniel. I'm happy to be here to give a broad overview of national patterns and trends in neighborhoods. I'm going to draw on some research we've done at the Furman Center, but also draw on research that many others have done. On slide two, slide seven, if you go to slide seven, this shows a set of press quotes from the popular media indicating that there's clearly growing concern about gentrification around the country as rents continue to rise, especially in coastal cities. But not only in coastal cities. If you turn to slide eight, you can see that even in Detroit, we are seeing signs of brewing concerns, as evidenced by this T-shirt that was sold by a vendor at the Detroit Marathon. And I want to briefly, in giving this overview, I really want to touch on kind of four questions today. First, are we seeing more gentrification in U.S. cities? Two, if so, why now? Three, what does research tell us about the consequences of that gentrification? And finally, and very briefly, how should policymakers respond? I know John and Harry will talk more in depth about policy responses. So turning to slide nine, I want to start by explaining what definition of gentrification I'm going to use. Gentrification is a term that means very different things to different people, so I think it's important to set out your definition up front. I'm going to define gentrification as significant increases in income, education, rents, or white population in initially low-income central city neighborhoods relative to any increases occurring in the rest of the metropolitan area. So in other words, gentrification implies that a neighborhood is climbing up the distribution of neighborhoods in the metropolitan area in terms of socioeconomic status. So given this definition, turning to slide 10 then, how much gentrification are we seeing? If you focus on the U.S. bars all the way to the left on this slide, they show that during the 2000s, 14% of initially low-income neighborhoods in U.S. cities saw large gains in income relative to their metropolitan area, up from 8% in the 1980s. We also look separately at three metropolitan areas, Chicago, New York, and San Francisco. And the trends are pretty similar there, but more dramatic in New York and San Francisco, particularly during the last decade. Slide 11 shows the percent of low-income central city tracts, central census tracts, which is our measure of neighborhoods, I should have said that already, seeing that saw large gains in percent college educated relative to their metropolitan area. Again, we consistently see a jump up during the last decade as indicated by the green bar. On slide 12, we see a similar pattern. Here we're looking at a relative jump in the non-Hispanic white population share, and you see that really jumped up during the last decade, during the 2000s. And on slide 13, perhaps most critically, we see really large increases in really large relative gains in rents during the 2000s. If you consider my hometown of New York on this slide, 40% of initially low-income central city neighborhoods in New York saw increases in rents that were significantly above those seen in the metropolitan area as a whole. So obviously a huge jump up from what was happening in the 1980s and the 1990s. So there does seem to be something, more gentrification happening in cities around the country. And on slide 14, the question is, why now? And this slide summarizes some excellent new research that offers some answers. And I should say that many of these papers that I'm drawing on here will be featured at an upcoming conference, a convening that's co-hosted by the Philadelphia Federal Reserve, the Minneapolis Federal Reserve, HUD, and the NYU Furman Center. These papers suggest that there are a number of forces driving the increase in gentrification. There's no one single answer. One is there's been an increasing demand for high-skilled workers in cities, and that has obviously drawn more more high-skilled people to come and residents to come to those cities, put pressure on house prices and rents. Secondly, I think changing demographics play a role. You're seeing that more people are waiting a little bit longer to have children and to get married, and those are, you know, the times, the life changes that when people have traditionally, middle class traditionally have moved to the suburbs, and so people are staying in the city for longer. I think changing tastes play a role as well. The research suggests that, you know, growing demand, there's sort of a growing taste for preference for the kind of consumption amenities that you can find in cities. And there's a growing demand on the part, of time-starved high-income workers for central locations in order to cut down on commuting time. And finally, I think that we've seen some pretty significant shifts in city environments over this time period. You know, I think cities are cleaner and cities are considerably safer. We saw, you know, a dramatic decline in crime and in violent crime in particular during the 1990s and continues and has, you know, continued during the 2000s. So I think that's sort of those are sort of some explanations for why this is happening now. Going on to slide 15, what about the consequences? One outcome that people understandably worry a lot about is displacement. You know, the research to date finds little evidence of direct displacement of poor renters. The research has found that gentrification and the kind of neighborhood changes are driven more by who it is, changes in who is moving into a neighborhood rather than who's moving out of it. And the existing papers haven't found much evidence of elevated exit rates among the poor in gentrifying areas. But I want to emphasize that most of that research focused on the 1990s. And if I won't go back on the slides, but as you recall, there was, you know, there's a real shift in I think the nature of gentrification that happened during the 2000s, and particularly we saw gentrification was accompanied by really large relative increases in rents during the 2000s in a way that we didn't see during the 1990s. So I think the research might find something very different in this last decade. We also there's one new study by Philadelphia Federal Reserve researchers that shows that in Philadelphia, low-income households that left gentrifying areas in Philadelphia tended to end up in lower-income areas. So they may not have left at any greater rate. They might not have been more likely to leave, but when they left, they ended up in a lower-income neighborhood. Secondly, I think that all, you know, much of the research is really focused on, a lot of it is sort of national averages, but displacement still may be a real threat. That may sort of mute the real threat that you see in some markets. And I think it's important to just emphasize that rising rents make it very difficult for newer low-income households to move into a neighborhood. And certainly, there are consequences for those who stay behind, as seen on slide 16. And there are threats that these households stay, especially sort of, you know, lower income households who may see or likely to see rising rents and rent burdens. They may see increased crowding. They may feel serious anxiety about displacement, and at the same time, you know, there are some opportunities. The rising rents tend to be accompanied by reductions in violent crime and increases in business activity, and I think, you know, there is some potential for you know, some maybe some hope, a sliver of hope for longer run economic integration as higher income households move into initially lower income neighborhoods, at least in the short term. So on slide 17, you know, policy responses. Again, this is very brief, just kind of a framework to think about the kinds of policy responses that cities might adopt. One would be to develop an early warning system to try to identify neighborhoods earlier in the process when policymakers have more room to respond and react. Secondly, protecting against displacement. So putting in place protections against displacement. That's going to involve monitoring landlord behavior to ensure there's no harassment, but also focusing on helping to stabilize tenants in place, helping tenants to stay in their homes, their emergency assistance, and also focusing on helping those families that do have to move in finding alternative homes and new homes. Third, I think that there's an important role for and local community groups, I think, maybe really are best equipped to do this, to link residents, to longtime residents, to new opportunities that may be emerging in their neighborhoods, whether that's job opportunities or youth activities, and to sort of help build bridges but across different sub-communities. And finally, I think that from a policy perspective, we should be focusing certainly on helping the residents that are there and have been in neighborhoods for a long time. But I also think we want to sort of take a long run view and try to put in place policies that can help to ensure economic integration over the longer run. And there are, a few ideas, a few strategies. One is to really leverage the hot market to develop and preserve affordable housing through inclusionary zoning, to build in, protections through community land trusts that Harry will describe. I think that it's possible to use federal housing subsidies strategically, perhaps to site subsidized housing in neighborhoods that are at risk of gentrification to try to lock in some long-run affordability. And finally, I think providing a set of incentives to private owners, perhaps tax subsidies, tax breaks, to keep rents affordable over the longer run. And I think that's all I want to say. Daniel, back to you.
Excellent. Thank you so much, Ingrid. There's so many good questions rolling in right now. You definitely hit a line with the audience where they're very curious about what you're talking about. So thank you for the thoughtful presentation. And we'll get to those questions, folks, as many as we can at the end of the session. But now I want to move on to slide 18 and turn things over to John Chen for your presentation.
Hi, thank you. So speaking about gentrification for Philadelphia Chinatown, there are many forces that have caused gentrification, but there are two that stand out in my mind. One is the downtown location of Chinatown, which makes it a desirable neighborhood and has significant impacts when the downtown real estate market rises. Second is that, as with many community development organizations, as we develop and improve our neighborhoods, we actually make our neighborhoods of choice. So these two underlying factors actually are causing some of the gentrification here in Philadelphia Chinatown. But let me just give you some context to my presentation. I was born and raised in Chinatown. I consider Chinatown my home. And although my parents moved our family out of Chinatown 30 years ago because they wanted more than a small apartment on top of a family restaurant, and Chinatown at that time just didn't have the affordability and the variety of housing stock, and this was during the mid-1980s. So very common for work-live neighborhoods with commercial quarters. So this was the path for my family and many families in Chinatown. I currently live in Philadelphia's Graduate Hospital area, which has seen significant gentrification just in the last 8 years, and it's 2 miles from Chinatown. In spite of this, however, Chinatown is my home and my community. I work in Chinatown. I attend church in Chinatown. and I work with the local Suns youth organization on Saturdays. So I'm pretty much in Chinatown 7 days out of the week. But today, Chinatown is really at a crossroads. The full effect of gentrification is bearing down on Philadelphia's Chinatown. If we look at Chinatowns in San Francisco, New York, and Boston, they have been challenged by gentrification for quite some time. And Philadelphia is looking to their communities for best practices. Just to give you a short history of Chinatown, like many other Chinatown communities across the country, ours started in 1870 as a bachelor society. The first business was a laundry that opened up on Race Street. At that time, Chinese faced a lot of discrimination, and discrimination included federal policy, something called the Chinese Exclusion Act of 1882, which only allowed merchants, students, and visitors into the United States. No families and no women. So Chinatowns were born out of necessity as a way for self-preservation. And similar to other Chinatowns, Philly's Chinatown was located in the least desirable part of town. We were in the red light district next to Skid Row at that time. And growing up, I still remember there was a bar on every corner in Chinatown. The fact is the government just did not serve the Chinese in this community. So the Christian Church and the Catholic Church started missionaries, along with family associations, which became benevolent associations to help new immigrants settle into Philadelphia. Their purposes were to find jobs and housing. And things were fine, but then as we move into the next years, we are faced with environmental injustice. And on clip 20, you'll see a couple pictures of from our archives about environmental injustice. You know, we were blighted eyesores as far as the city government was concerned, and we were targeted for many urban renewal project proposals. We had federal prisons, a Greyhound bus station, the Pennsylvania Convention Center. We had a commuter rail tunnel that was built under Chinatown. And the Convention Center actually designed its building so that its back and loading docks were facing Chinatown. Then we moved to the year 2000 when the Phillies baseball team proposed a stadium right next to Chinatown. But of course, the one big proposal that started our nonprofit organization was the Vine Street Expressway that was proposed in 1966. They proposed to take away Chinatown's only church and school at that time. And all in all, Chinatown's lost 25% of its land to urban projects. So this was the beginning of the battle for Chinatown's preservation. PCDC and the community organizations coalesced and strategized to fight for Chinatown's protection and preservation. And it seemed to us that every 7 years, there was another project that was proposed for Chinatown but had very, very little benefit for Chinatown. But it was more a greater good for the city. So there were long battles, and the movement in Chinatown's first battle with the Vine Street Expressway successfully saved the church and school. And the battle resulted in a scaled-down version of the Vine Street Expressway. If we jump to the slide that with aftermath of urban renewal, this is the period of Chinatown's history where we begin to figure out how to converse with the city government, how to plan for Chinatown's own growth and preservation. And this period was called the Save Chinatown Movement, and it's incredibly important for Chinatown's place in the city today. Not only did it divert a major crisis for the community, but it changed the whole dynamics between Chinatown and the city. In this period, we developed Chinatown's first master plan called the Chad Bourne Report in 1970. And since that time, up into the 2000s, it's led to the development of 226 units of affordable housing, but also made Chinatown a destination and began, I guess, Chinatown's slippery slope towards gentrification. If we move to the next slide, in the year 2000, this was the period of growth, economic development, and physical transformation. We updated Chinatown's neighborhood plan in 2004, and to the success of that plan, we completely transformed the Vine Street Expressway, overcame its physical challenges, improved pedestrian safety, added little parks and greening, all to the benefit and health of the residents in the community. At the same time, we knew that we had to invest in the economic commercial corridor of Chinatown with a four-prong approach in the Main Street program of greening, cleaning, economic investment, design, and promotion. Knowing that Chinatown is a gateway for new immigrants, it was important that this economy was sustained so that folks in the community had jobs. Moving forward to lemons and lemonade slide. This was the time period in 2006-2008 where we actually attracted $5 million in government and foundation investment to tame the Vine Street Expressway, to reduce and eliminate its characteristic as a highway for automobiles and transform it into more of a city street, more for pedestrians and residents. And as you can see, a little sample in the right-hand corner, it's a little park green space that we actually built over a bridge that goes over the highway. And moving on to community development at its best, here are two photos of the perfect example of our work to create, to make Chinatown a destination. Here you have photos of an outdoor event that we've held for the last 6 years called the Chinatown Night Market. Last October, it drew 25,000 visitors to Chinatown. And so we've created a destination that attracts mixed-income visitors and attracts and creates a mixed-income neighborhood. And if we move to the statistics, we will see that in the 1970s, Chinatown had 750 residents. In 2000, the population grew to 5,000. And in 2010, we had 8,000 residents, which is a 60% increase in our population. We continue to be an immigrant community, but the diversity has changed. Interesting in our statistics, we found that the population growth drivers were the growing Asian and Hispanic population, and we found that very interesting. If we go to the next few slides, here's some graphs and demographics. We look at this and we see that Chinatown's population, 67% in our survey say that English is not their first language, and in fact, Chinese is their first language. So there is diversity, but Chinatown is predominantly still Chinese-American. The following slide shows the income diversity. Yes, the higher income residential population is growing. As you can see up top, about 15% earn $70,000 or more. But the fact is it's that Chinatown pretty much remains a very, very impoverished community with 43% of its population earning $10,000 or less. If we move to the next slide, an interesting fact that we found during our survey is that Chinatown actually has residents, 30-some percent of our residents, almost 30% of our residents, have lived in Chinatown 30 years or more. You know, we hope this trend continues because what that means is that we're able to stave off gentrification. You know, I think this speaks to the demand of residents wanting to remain in Chinatown. Moving to the next slide. So what are the challenges? We have significant challenges in Chinatown, none of which at least is affordability. Affordable housing development is lagging market rate housing, and we know that federal HUD dollars and block grants are greatly diminished. And for our Chinatown, the opportunity and the land available to build more affordable housing is very limited. And another challenge around affordability is the need for the city of Philadelphia to come up with a citywide plan for affordable housing and the preservation of. So we have physical challenges as well. And we have a highway that runs through Chinatown, and it's been very difficult. We've had some successes, but it continues to be difficult to sort of manage to develop around that highway. Another challenge is once we attain mixed income neighborhood, which we have now, but it's continued to be more mixed income, now what? We hope we're not at the tipping point, but I'm afraid to say that I think we've gone beyond that tipping point where we are now worried about preservation of affordability. And for our community, what that really means is what's the future and what's the opportunity for leadership development? Who's the next generation of residents who will keep the government and resources focused on affordability? And as you saw in the previous graph, extreme poverty is only one issue. We know that impoverished families have health, employment, and educational attainment issues, and this is very much so for Chinatown's immigrant community. And with many of our immigrant communities, political participation is another challenge. You know, on the strength side, there's three points that I just want to raise with you. Chinatown has a very, very strong community and organizational leadership network and infrastructure. I think because we are identified as Chinatown, we have a long history and a tradition of organizing and advocacy that has a national reputation. And in spite of the land limitations, there's an area that we call Chinatown North where there is land to develop, but it requires the help of city agencies and city policies on affordability. So in closing, what are the opportunities? You've heard some of the opportunities from Ingrid. It's really community benefits agreements and coalition building. But I want to point out two very specific organizations that are doing work either around Chinatowns or Philadelphia. One is the National Capacity, which is a membership organization of Asian American nonprofits around the country. And they just launched the report called Asian American Pacific Islander Anti-Displacement Report yesterday. I hope you get a chance to take a look at it because it provides solutions at the local level. And secondly, in Philadelphia, we have the Association of Community Development Corporations. There's three prongs to the approach that they're pushing for. One, doubling the housing trust fund in Philadelphia. Two, work and support for storefront improvement programs because we know that low-income neighborhoods have businesses that hire from the neighborhood. And lastly, permanent affordable housing through tools like the land trust. So thank you.
Thank you so much, John, just for your thoughts on what's happening in the neighborhood where you're working. Looking forward to getting more into that with some questions here in a few minutes after Harry's presentation. But before we get into Harry's presentation, I actually want to go back to the audience again and pose another question. So a question is going to pop up on your screen momentarily, and that question is simply this. Have you heard of the community land trust model? Two answers there, yes or no. As you're thinking about that, again, just a reminder, submit your questions. Either click on the Ask a Question button on the webinar, or you can send them to us at communities@stls.frb.org. Let's go ahead and close the question and see what the response is. Oh, Harry, look at this. 69% of folks say yes, they are familiar and have heard of the community land trust model. 31% of our audience says they have not. So with that, Harry, I'll turn it over to you for your presentation.
Perfect. My job is almost done. Good afternoon, everybody. Thanks for being on this webinar, and very exciting to be here and help wrap this part up. Today I'm going to talk about our experience of the Dudley Street Neighbor Initiative and Dudley Neighbors, Inc., Community Land Trust, and share some of the lessons we've learned over 30-plus years of organizing and planning. And in doing that, I'll lay out some of the features of the Community Land Trust model and some of the benefits and some issues as a tool to prevent development without displacement and impact gentrification. So moving to slide 34, just a little background about the Dudley Neighborhood and Dudley Street Neighborhood Initiative. The Dudley Neighborhood is located in the Roxbury North Dorchester section of Boston, Massachusetts, named recently as the fastest gentrifying city in the United States, which is a dubious distinction that we're all working around. There in our neighborhood, there are about 26,000 residents, very diverse community of African-American, Latino, Cape Verdean, and white families, with 35% of the families at or below the federal poverty line. You can see from some of these slides, when Dudley Street was founded in 1984, there were about 1,300 blighted vacant lots in the neighborhood. This was pretty much the result of public and private policy decisions that had led to disinvestment, arson for profit, and widespread abandonment of homes. And Dudley, in essence, became a dumping ground, the epicenter of illegal dumping in the city of Boston. And even though it was only 2 miles from downtown Boston, it was kind of became a forgotten community. I'll say in context of this conversation that even during the worst years of the blight and disinvestment and dumping, community leaders were always very aware that the proximity of Dudley to downtown brought along with it the possibility of future gentrification and displacement. So moving to slide 35, Dudley Street got started with the Don't Dump on Us campaign, which was a campaign literally organized by hundreds of residents to try to clean up vacant land and force the city to close illegal trash transfer stations that dotted the neighborhood, as well as ending illegal dumping. Back in those days, the neighbors were just looking at anything they could do to try to address the quality of life and safety issues that were happening in the neighborhood, and no idea was too far-fetched. One strategy that a brilliant community leader came up with was in order to deal with more than 100 stolen cars that were dotting the neighborhood and the city wasn't dealing with them, she went down to the mayor's reelection office, campaign office, and got bumper stickers for the sitting mayor and put them all over the stolen cars. And within 48 hours, the cars had been all towed away. So at that point, nothing was too far-fetched to try to call attention to the situation and advocate for improvements. But as we started getting successful and stopping illegal dumping and closing some of these trash transfer stations, residents realized that they could quickly become victims of their own success, that cleaning up the vacant lots and stopping illegal dumping was not enough, and that without real control over planning and land use decision, the community would just be in a reactive mode. And in fact, the city of Boston had developed a master plan for the Dudley neighborhood that included a high degree of market rate housing, hotels, and other features. The only issue was they hadn't really consulted with the neighborhood about their plan. So DS and I essentially ripped up the city's plan and embarked on our own visioning and planning processes with hundreds of residents who had not been involved in planning before, and came up with an urban village plan that called for mixed income housing, retail, commercial space, parks, playgrounds, other amenities of the urban village. And this is where our Take a Stand, Own the Land campaign came about, really targeting the approximately 30 acres of land in the Dudley Triangle, half of which was owned by the city and half by private owners. And this is when we began to explore the community land trust model, and in 1989, the Dudley Neighbors, Inc. Land Trust was formed, and the neighborhood began to put parcels together and work with partners to develop the vision. So in slide 36, I'm just going to stop for a second around in talking about the Dudley example, hit the pause button, and just talk a little bit about what is a community land trust. Basically, a community land trust is a nonprofit organization that develops and stewards affordable housing, community gardens, civic spaces, commercial spaces, and other community assets. They are governed by a board of land trust residents, community residents, and often public representatives that provide lasting community assets and permanently affordable housing opportunities. There are other types of land trusts out there, conservation land trusts and other entities, But the community land trust model really starts with the C, with the community and the governance model, and making sure that residents are really in the lead. So slide 37, I'll just give another illustration of how the model works. So basically, Dudley Neighbors, Inc., in this case, and the community land trust owns the land under the home. The family owns the home. They're able to purchase the home at an affordable price. They have to get a mortgage, and they're able to build some equity in the home. The land trust holds on to the land, and there's a ground lease, in our case, a 99-year ground lease, that is the link between the land and the home. In this case, that allows, when the home is sold, the home is sold at an affordable price due to the deed restrictions and the ground lease. So that ensures that the home remains affordable and that the subsidies are preserved and carried over to the next families. In our case, we really put an emphasis on the long-term stability of the neighborhood, and that's how we wrote our ground lease. Land trusts, there's over 250 land trusts around the country, and they all have different conditions, different market conditions, and different priorities on how quickly how much they make the balance between the kind of individual asset building and community asset building. So there's no one correct model. It's a very flexible tool. So moving on to slide 38, I just want to talk about a couple features of the land trust model. First of all is real emphasis on perpetual affordability, that the price is lower initially, it's lower again at resale. That continues on and on in perpetuity. In our case, it's a 99-year lease that we fully intend to then renew after 99 years. And this really allows us to go beyond the city's affordable housing covenants, which expire after 50 years, and make sure that the initial subsidy of the property is maintained throughout the life of the home. Residents are building equity in the home, but they're avoiding the boom and bust cycle that we all experienced several years ago, and that comes around, you know, every generation. So that's a really important feature of the land trust model, the fact that that the subsidy stays in the project forever. Also, the fact that we own title to the land means that the land trust can intervene if any attempts are made to break the resale guidelines. We're able to intervene and ensure that there can't be a refinancing or a sale that goes through that isn't in line with our requirements. Second feature of this model is that is the issue of stabilization. And at the time that the land trust was formed, Dudley was a weak market, and there was very little private investment happening in the neighborhood. But because the community had developed a common vision, the land trust became a vehicle to plan our future success. And 30 years later, housing prices have skyrocketed. A lot of families are unable to stay in their homes due to rents being increased. They're unable to buy homes in the neighborhood. But residents in Dudley knew enough back then to create a vehicle that could really keep part of the community's housing stock affordable. And this is definitely a message as we get asked about the ability of the land trust to function in hot and colder neighborhoods and markets, that even if you're in a market that is not super heated, we always say that, you know, communities and municipalities need to plan for their success, and they shouldn't be giving away precious public land without a long-term plan that that ensures affordability. Moving on to slide 39, just an example of the impact of land trusts on long-term success in homes. One of the strengths of the land trust is that we don't go away. We stay and support homeowners to be successful. You can see from this chart, during the height of the foreclosure crisis, fewer than 1% of land trust homes around the country were foreclosed on, compared to 5% of total mortgages. In the Dudley example, there were over 200 homes foreclosed on between 2008 and 2013 in the Roxbury neighborhood, and none of them happened on our land trust. And we've only had four foreclosures in 25 years on the land trust. So it really makes the land trust an island of stability as during the boom and bust cycle, and allows us to intervene with banks and residents and work out strategies to keep people in their homes. And this is one of the key features, you know, beliefs of DS&I, that for a community to be thriving and stabilizing, you have to have a very healthy pool of successful homeowners. So I want to switch to slide 40 just to show you, come back to the DS&I example 25 years later, and just show you on the left is the slide Dudley Triangle in 1989, which is 62 acres of land, and the black boxes are represent vacant land, either public or private land. And on the right, you have the Dudley Triangle, and the colored blocks represent new housing and other features on the land trust. The land trust now owns 32 of the 62 acres in the Dudley Triangle. So going to slide 41, you can see what is on our land trust in 2016, including 226 permanently affordable homes with a mix of homeownership, limited equity cooperative, and rental, so that the homes were accessible to families with a mix of incomes. Also, 2 acres of community farmland, playgrounds, community greenhouse, nonprofit space, commercial space, all the different features of a thriving urban village. That was another key part, is that this isn't just about housing. We're looking at how residents really came together and looked at a vision for the whole community. And as we're going forward, over the next 3 to 5 years, we're looking at adding at least 50 to 60 new homes onto the land trust, in part through the Mayor of Boston's Neighborhood Homes Initiative, which calls for one-third affordable, one-third moderate, and one-third market rate homes to be built on remaining city-owned land. And the affordable and moderate homes would go onto our land trust. We've also are working with other groups around the city in emerging land trusts and groups interested in land trusts, and we formed the Greater Boston CLT Network. And most recently, Chinatown actually has formed the Chinatown Community Land Trust and is moving forward trying to acquire property. So we're trying to build resources and policies that would support the growth of community control and land trusts. So moving to the next two slides, 42, is just a quick before shot of Dennis Street right in the heart of the Dudley Triangle back in the 1980s. And then this is kind of typical of what the vacant lots look like. And then slide 43 shows you what it looks like as of a few weeks back.
Great. Thank you so much, Harry, Sorry, Harry, you cut out for a second.
Oh, sorry. Am I still here?
You're still there.
Okay. So this is what it looks like today. And so it's just an example of the physical revitalization of the neighborhood. And I just want to conclude, there's a lot more to say, but I think just to conclude that the land trust is a very powerful tool as part of a larger community resident-driven engagement process and community organizing process. That goes along with things other people have mentioned, whether it's community benefits agreements or linkage or inclusionary development or other pieces where residents are advocating for more resources and policies for affordable housing. And you know, but we believe the CLT, the land trust model, is uniquely positioned to be a vehicle for development without displacement, and really ensure that the families who fought so hard to clean and improve the neighborhoods are not forced out. So I'll leave it at that. I know we want to open it up for questions and discussion. Thank you.
That's excellent, Harry. Thank you so much for sharing with us a little bit about the model that you're experiencing there in your neighborhood. I do want to get to as many of these questions as we're able to, and we've had quite a bit of overlap, so I'm going to combine a couple of these questions. And Ingrid, I want to start with you. I have a pair of questions, and the first one I'll give you a chance to respond to, and then I'll go on to the second one. Some folks really writing in, curious to know about, you mentioned on, I think it was slide 16, how there was an opportunity that gentrification could lead to long-run economic and racial integration. Could you speak a little bit more about that and just unpack that opportunity for us?
Yeah, I mean, as somebody who has, I mean, I've spent much of my career studying segregation in neighborhoods, you know, poverty concentration and racial segregation, and have learned that, you know, much of the, you know, much of what really, what keeps and maintains segregation and racial segregation in this country is the unwillingness of white households to move into largely minority neighborhoods. And so there is sort of a piece of this that it's sort of those that is, you know, I kind of, you know, you sort of want to embrace the fact that you have higher income households and college educated white households who are choosing to move into urban neighborhoods, economically racially diverse neighborhoods. But on the other hand, right, the risk is that rents are going to rise, and in the long run, that is no longer going to be a neighborhood that is diverse and welcome to people with a range of different incomes and backgrounds. And so, I mean, it, it seems like, I mean, I think that one possibility is one one really, I think, critical tool. I mean, yes, community land trusts would be is an incredibly powerful tool. I think it is a little bit more complicated when you haven't set that up already. But I think that you know, different kinds of place-based, permanently affordable, subsidized housing really do provide you know, they're a critical tool in maintaining some economic diversity in these neighborhoods as they change. And you know, one of the things I think, you know, we are somewhat fortunate in New York in that we have invested a tremendous amount in subsidized housing. And, you know, in some neighborhoods, that's sort of the only economic diversity left. But at least, you know, we have the majority of public housing in New York City actually is in gentrifying neighborhoods. And so I think that sort of thinking about that in different cities around the country and really thinking about the critical need to preserve those subsidized housing units and in neighborhoods that are experiencing gentrification. And it, it may be a way that we've spent a lot of time over the last year. We've gotten a lot of attention to Raj Chetty's work on the long-run benefits of moving to opportunity, but there might be ways to actually create, you know, maybe gentrification can be an opportunity if somehow we can lock in that affordability and so we preserve some integration over the longer run. So it's both an opportunity, but it's also a real challenge because, you know, without any public action, these neighborhoods, many of these neighborhoods may not remain economically diverse over the long run.
I certainly appreciate just that response. I appreciate that. The next question that comes in for you, Ingrid, really has to do with a lot of the conversation today has focused on the demand side of the perspective and how that leads to gentrification. How much of the underlying factors that lead to gentrification are actually caused by the supply side, so that there may not be enough housing to actually meet the increased demand for inner city housing, or cities like San Francisco or Boston that may not have the construction rates in the inner city that they need to keep up with
with
demand?
Sorry, I'm interrupting you. It's a it's clearly a combination, and so I think what we've seen is we're seeing this sort of, you know, refueled demand for city living, particularly on the part of young college-educated adults, and unfortunately, as that demand has grown, the supply of housing hasn't kept up, and so it's really that combination. Now, some of that is regulatory barriers, some of that is real, you know, land restrictions. But I think that, you know, that is absolutely essential that we keep on pushing on you know, building more housing and building more affordable housing.
Thanks for that. And Harry, I want to come to you with a question.
I would also say that sort of regional solutions as well, I should say, right?
Investing
in regional transit that makes, I mean, one of the things that makes these neighborhoods so attractive is they're so accessible, and especially in cities that don't, where our public transit networks might not live up to their full promise. So I think that's critical, a critical part of the equation too.
Great. And I want to come to Harry with the question. We have an audience member who wrote in saying, how are community land trust initiatives going to scale now that urban land in Boston is so extremely expensive, unlike the 80s? So, I mean, it's all well and good for a weak market like Dudley was when you started it, but how does this really move to scale now?
No, it's a great question. And like I said, there are land trusts that are operating in weaker markets and land trusts operating in hotter markets. And it's some ways, it's we look at it and say it's never a bad time. Like there are people who say, I wish I had set up a land trust 20 years ago. There's places when we go talk with Detroit or Baltimore who say, well, we want to set up a land trust to ensure that at least a good percentage of our stock is, you know, is affordable going forward. In Boston, you know, even though it's true, there's not the same kind of you know, vast acreage of land and you know, that can be acquired cheaply from the city or privately, there's still a lot of opportunities. The city owns hundreds and hundreds of foreclosed buildings and vacant lots. Banks own another large number of properties and formerly foreclosed properties that you know, can still be in play in terms of using them for community benefit and for affordable housing and other uses. Some of this is a question of kind of political will and resources. While there's not a kind of magic pool of financing or money that comes along with the land trust, we are advocating with other land trusts and other neighborhoods to try to get, you know, acquisition financing, to try to get, you know, pilot projects that would allow resources to flow towards trying to acquire these properties. So it's a very valid point, and it is a very different different kind of scenario than it was 30 years ago. But there are still parts of the city that do have a lot of remaining vacant land that the city's moving forward with on requests for proposals, and the land trust model becomes a vehicle for residents to really express their desires about kind of what they would like to see, and then hopefully have the land trust play a long-term role in ensuring that gets built.
Appreciate that, Harry. And John, I want to turn to you with a question that one audience member sends in. Just curious to know, from your perspective, as the organization that you are, how can other organizations like yours and neighborhoods across the country preserve affordability in gentrifying neighborhoods? Are there practical actions that they can take with landlords and local governments in those neighborhoods that you would suggest?
Yeah, I think the landlord question is much more difficult. I don't know if we have an answer for you. But, you know, New York City is very different where they actually have certain rent control policies. So that seems to have worked in New York City. So as far as the other work, best practices, again, I'm going to reference the National Capacity Anti-Displacement effort. There is a model that's being promoted in working with small businesses. Just as housing has become more expensive, so has rents for small store owners. And with communities like Chinatowns, where the economy is so important to the livelihood of the residents, who are mostly immigrants, there has to be a way to figure out how to make rent affordable. So there are ideas to use government grant funding for commercial corridors or other kinds of technical assistance to help small business owner become more efficient, help them with marketing promotion. But, you know, the landlord question has been an issue for decades and hundreds of years. But you do raise an important point, and I don't know if I answered the question, but these are some of the things we're looking at.
I appreciate that. I want to try to squeeze just a couple more questions, and I know we're right there at the top of the hour. So folks on the line, if you can stick around for 5 extra minutes with us, I just want to try to get a few more questions in. And Harry, I'm actually going to come back to you. A audience member writes in, curious to know what strategies were used in the Dudley neighborhood to actually build the interest of the local residents to become engaged in town planning and neighborhood visioning?
Well, I think we had the we had the advantage of the city really pushing a plan that a lot of people didn't like. So it was definitely one organizing hook was the fact that there were people were not happy with what was being presented and didn't feel like they were part of it. The other thing we've done and we try to do is try to make planning more interesting and more relevant for different sectors of the community who aren't typically involved. And so that could be, you know, making sure that language capacity, that childcare is there, that that there's creative, that arts and culture are integrated into planning so that you're talking with families from all different education and backgrounds and economic levels. One of the things we've done most recently is start doing projects right on vacant land where young people would host pop-up art exhibits, and you would be able to come by and text what you wanted to see on that land. And as a old-time organizer who's happy to get 40 people in a room to talk about a vacant lot, they were getting like 200 people to text in and demand that the city do something with that land and say what they wanted to see. And so we're always trying to evolve and get more creative about how to do it. I think the last thing is that when people start to see results and they see that some of these vacant lots and dumping sites get closed and things start to get built, that really just generates the momentum. And remember, this happened over 25 years, so it wasn't overnight, and people, you know, did drop out and come back in, but because it's a very tight-knit community, you know, we've been able to keep the momentum going.
I appreciate that, Harry. And Ellen or Ingrid, I want to come back to you with a question that a lot of folks are writing in, curious about the role of preserving small business in this whole matter. So we've talked a lot about housing, but is there research on actually preserving small business as an effort within the gentrification process?
So, you know, there is a there's really sort of budding research on that. Actually, we have two papers at this upcoming Federal Reserve HUD Furman Center convening that we're going to have in a couple weeks, and those papers will be available that focus on the implications for local businesses. So, I can't say that there is a lot of information. I think we need to know more about that. There's some evidence that employment opportunities do go up, that the number of people employed in a neighborhood goes up after as a neighborhood gentrifies, but it's not entirely clear that those jobs are filled by local residents, and I think that's the real question.
And Ingrid, could you share the date of the upcoming convening with folks?
It's May 25th.
May 25th. A lot of folks curious about that on this session. Well, folks, I'm afraid we've actually hit our max for today's time, and so we're going to have to wrap things up. I definitely want to thank just our tremendous presenters for their contributions today. So a special thanks to Ingrid and to John and to Harry just for making your time available and for answering some of the questions that our audience has had as well. For those of you that shot in questions and we weren't quite able to get to them, we'll try to respond to some of those as we're able to via email after the session. I also want to make sure I thank the Philadelphia Federal Reserve Bank just for their organization of today's session. And lastly, I want to let folks know that our next Connecting Community session will actually take place on June 14th. And that title, the session is titled, What It's Worth, Strengthening the Financial Future of Families, Communities, and the Nation. Thank you so much. This concludes today's session.